welcome everyone to another installment of our ABR podcast series. Today we have Amrit Kumar, who is the President and Chief Scientific Officer at Zilliqa, on the ABR podcast series today. Zilliqa is the leading high-security blockchain platform that looks to pioneer a more open financial system across the region. Having recently celebrated its third birthday, Zilliqa has seen a successful year thus far and is set to continue this momentum as it embarks on several new partnerships with more to come in the pipeline. So let's dive right into it. Firstly, Amrit, thank you for your time. At ABR, we are always looking for the movers and shakers in the world of blockchain. So how has 2020 been so far with the new normal? How are you doing and how is the company faring?
Thank you very much, Anil, for inviting me over, and hello to everyone listening to ABR podcast. Well, 2020, I would say, wasn't very different for us compared to last year, for example. And the reason is we all are in this blockchain world where teams are distributed. So we have, roughly speaking, a 30-member team right now, and close to 40% of them are actually working remotely. So we have people based in Copenhagen, people in Russia. I'm leading the team. I'm based in London. A big chunk of our team is still in Singapore, but in terms of work-wise, that is, we have been very used to working remotely in a setup where most of the communication happens very asynchronously on Slack. So in terms of team dynamics, nothing has changed for us. In fact, the last, I would say, 3 to 4 months, we have been very active in hiring because we felt that this is the right time to fish and identify people in the market who would be good for us. So we have been rather aggressive, I would say, in the last 6 to 8 months in terms of building the team or developing the project. Because even in terms of you think about project development, this is the time when you cannot go and out meet and do business meetings. It means that you have to focus something internally. It was a time for us to think, introspect, think about strategy and how you want to move forward, and then do anything around internal restructuring or making sure the team is motivated. And that's all that, nothing really has changed beyond that. But yes, I know people who have been doing fundraise, for example, other projects. That has not been very straightforward because, like it or not, when you talk to investors, you do want to talk to people face to face. So for some projects, I know my friends, they have had a hard time, but for us, nothing really has changed. But it is business as usual.
Yeah, the fundraising is definitely an element that is kind of affected by this whole pandemic that we're seeing right now. I think one of my previous guests as well have kind of alluded to that. In your line, like in what you guys do, have you been facing any problems on the fundraising side, or are you guys doing any sort of fundraising activities right now, or is that kind of on the back burner?
Yeah, so we have Zilliqa Research, which is the entity behind the Zilliqa protocol that we developed. It did a fundraise back in end 2017, early 2018. So we raised close to around $22 million back then. And we have been using those funds for software development and paying salaries and stuff like that. We are not planning to do any fundraise directly for Zilliqa Research right now. However, very recently we announced a separate venture that is called Zilliqa Capital. And the goal of Zilliqa Capital is twofold. Number one, we have found that in this region, especially the Southeast Asian region, and including India, for example, there are a lot of good projects, especially blockchain projects. For example, in India, every other day, we see projects like Instadap that was developed as a part of hackathon in India. These projects, they don't have a good VC funding available in India. And similarly for Singapore, if you look at Singapore and let's say Malaysia and that region, the number of crypto VCs that are out there supporting these projects are very few. So what ends up happening is many of these projects have to reach out to Silicon Valley VCs. And then the deal happens too. What we felt that this could be solved if you could have a very decent sized VC set up in this region focused on crypto investments. And so that was one goal. The second goal was, what we're seeing is that, like it or not, there are a lot of projects in the Zilliqa ecosystem that would love to have some big ticket investments. For example, early in the days when we launched our mainnet, we had this protocol, app called Unstoppable Domains. And they're developing sort of domain name systems based on blockchains. And so we had from our grant program, which we have been running for a while now, we were able to provide a seed funding to this company. But later on, they had to reach out to Silicon Valley VCs to be able to have a big ticket investments. So what we would like to see also from our side, purely from Zilliqa research perspective, is that we would like to have VCs around this Zilliqa ecosystem that could invest heavily in and around what's being developed for Zilliqa protocol. And that's another goal that we are trying to do with Zilliqa Capital. So obviously, Zilliqa Capital is something that we need fundraise. So we have not started the fundraise yet. Not because of COVID, but it's just because we're not ready yet. So we're doing all the paperwork and handling the legalities of things. But yeah, we may be able to start the fundraise in around 2 months' time once we are ready. But yeah, we are doing that fundraise, but not directly for Zilliqa Research, but for Zilliqa Capital.
Right. Yeah, actually, my next question was going to be about, how the commercial operations have been affected by COVID. But I think you did kind of explain that before, that, everything is just pretty much business as usual. But there was one thing that I found quite interesting from what you were talking about just now. India, right? How do you see the ecosystem in India right now, like just from a blockchain perspective and crypto sort of like investment like kind of climate? What are your thoughts on the market?
Yeah, so if you look back around, let's say 2016, 17, the ICO era, golden era, people were focusing a lot on countries like Japan, because of friendly regulations, things were more structured there. Korea, because there were huge investments coming from Korea, retail crowd were actually, what I heard from people is that they were literally carrying bags of cash and going to places where they could buy crypto assets. America, obviously, is one of the biggest markets where retail invests heavily in crypto projects. However, things are changing a little bit, especially if you look at India. We don't talk about too much of Japan anymore right now. But if you look at India, for example, there is a huge developer crowd base there, right? You have literally every other street, if you go around in Bangalore, which is one of the cities back in south of India, this is sort of called the Silicon Valley of India. And there are engineering colleges and institutions producing engineers and grooming engineers every other day. And if you just look at the sheer crowd of and the talent that they have in terms of engineers, it's huge. So even if people, so India is interesting from two angles. One is from the developer. So people who are, because the fact of the matter is right now, all blockchain projects are looking for developers to come up with creative ideas of dApps that can be built on top of the platforms. And from that angle, India is a very interesting place to go, because even if you're able to capture 1% of the developer base there, that's going to beat any other country for that matter. Very recently, I was looking at some of the reports on open source development. So around, let's say, 10 years ago, there was this sort of understanding and belief that Asian countries were mostly consumers of open source projects. They were not contributors of open source projects. So for example, if someone develops a library, then Asians would only be using that library in their own projects, but won't be contributing back to that library. This has definitely changed over the last, I would say, 5 years, where if you look right now, China, particularly India, the second place, even Singapore and Hong Kong are actually becoming very attractive places to see open source developer talent. So this is one group where India, I think, excels in terms of sheer number of developers that are out there. The second is about the market size. So, Japan, Korea, they're all huge markets, but if you just look at the size of the market that India presents with its population, that's huge. So if you can capture even a tiny percentage of that market share, if let's say even just for attracting investments, that could be huge. By investments, I don't mean institutional investments, by investments, I mean retail investments. So if you're looking for projects to people to come on board towards your open source, crowdsourced platform, then India could be a good place to be there. Regulation-wise, things have been a little bit shaky in India in the last month or so, but I'm hoping that it will definitely change given that this whole world is moving towards a scenario where people are getting attracted towards Bitcoin and blockchains in general.
Yeah, what do you think about the, you know, the regulatory side of things? Well, what's your gut feeling about what's happening in India? Do you think this government is ready to make some sort of, you know, bold moves, or are they just gonna keep things a bit status quo and kind of adopt a bit of a wait and see attitude? What's your gut feeling?
Yes, I think the government have sent some mixed signals over the last year or so. Things sometimes felt like India is going to ban crypto entirely, or India is going to shut down all exchanges that are operating there. So things have been very unclear, and very mixed signals have been coming along. But I know that the market that India has needs a little bit more of education. It's not like the US market where people in every household probably would know about Bitcoin or have heard about Bitcoin. There's a lot of marketing that's happening. For example, Grayscale, recently you may have heard about them.
Yep.
They are pushing a heavy marketing around crypto assets in the US.
Right.
So a lot of education needs to be done. I won't say that I'm very confident to say that India is one of the most educated country in terms as far as crypto education is concerned.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing advocates and people, a good friend of mine from one of the leading exchanges there in India, they are putting a lot of efforts into educating the lawmakers, educating the relevant parties who are there in India and making decisions. It will take a bit of time, but I'm sure that education will definitely play a huge role in changing the way things are perceived by the government in India.
Yeah, actually, I was just wondering if you have any perspectives on the recent announcement in China where they've come up with this blockchain service network. It's got a few ecosystem partners, some open source sort of fabrics like Hyperledger and so on, and that it could probably have a bit of Chinese characteristics, and then you've got the whole central bank digital currency concept, which is also coming into play, and then when you marry all this with their One Belt and One Road initiative and all that, you're looking at a country that could potentially lock in at least 2/3 of the world in a new sort of ecosystem. Do you have any perspectives on what's happening in China?
Yeah, so I've talked to a few people involved in the BSN project. This is a blockchain service network project out of China. What I'm getting from my discussions with the relevant parties there is that there are two flavors to what they're doing. One is a flavor very China specific, given that there are restrictions there. And then there's one international flavor of it. And in the international favor, for example, they are looking at projects and even entities, for example, in Sri Lanka, Cambodia, India, and other places, to run some of their nodes in some sense. So I won't say that it's purely, though, even though it's originating from China, of China flavor in some sense. People involved in BSN project, they're also sort of putting an international flavor to it by having a parallel sort of process out there. And they have seen, as you probably may have noticed, they have integrated with a bunch of projects, both public and private. So they have integrated with, for example, Chainlink recently, and I think they're probably also going to support EOS and Ethereum very soon.
Right.
I'm not sure at this point of time how different the integration of public and private chains would be. For example, from a user's perspective, how things would look like when they interact with a permission network like, let's say, Hyperledger or Corda. And on the other hand, they interact with something like Ethereum, because the way Ethereum has developed over the last 2 years, a lot of things are all the tools and infrastructure are already out there. So I would be very interested in seeing how they are able to bring the crowd that's actually developing right now on public chains to be able to use that network. But yeah, it's more than, I would say, the way it's being projected, it's certainly more than China, at least. It definitely has international flavor to what they're doing.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? So it's definitely a global sort of ecosystem that they're gunning for, right?
Right.
So just moving on. This is more just about the journey of digital development that has kind of occurred within Zilliqa. It's a bit of a broad question, but it's about DeFi, decentralized finance.
Right.
And, the whole DeFi space has been just growing. The market caps are just, in the billions now. Smart contract protocols, open source protocols, and decentralized applications as well, which are just, reimagining how we do things. With DeFi as a prelude to a more innovative and open financial ecosystem, it may be time for the blockchain industry to kind of leverage this momentum and unlock the future of open finance. I'm quite sure, in more mature markets, like you were alluding to, a lot of education has already happened. And of course, in emerging markets, it could be a bit of a struggle. So
right.
I'm just wondering about, your big picture sort of take on DeFi and where you see Zilliqa kind of fitting into this narrative.
Right. So the way I see it is, there are sort of two schools right now in some sense. One school believes in pure decentralization, where they see we are going to develop something that's not going to rely on any central infrastructure, and we are going to develop things that are community driven, and decisions will be made and with the help of community. And then there's other sort of group of people or the school which believes in combining what you see right now in the traditional financial space and then bringing slowly towards the blockchain world.
Right.
And both have been successful in their own ways. For example, if you look at MakerDAO. So MakerDAO was a project designed to solve this problem about stablecoins. Because all the stablecoins that you could see prior to MakerDAO, for example, USDT, they were all backed by fiat. You can question all the auditability of the money held by the custodians, but the idea was brilliant. The idea was to be able to have a volatile asset like ETH and yet use that volatile asset like Ether to develop a stable coin, stable asset. So that was very powerful. On the other hand, if you see, for example, assets like USDT, I would probably say that it might be a little bit of exaggeration, but I would probably say that USDT is probably one of the very few assets out there, blockchain assets developed on top of platforms, that have found some product market fit. People are using that USDT, for example, or any assets like stable coins backed by fiat, at least for trading activities. So when people want to come out of the volatility of Bitcoin or ZILS or Ether, they would like to go back to USDT or USDC. So stable coins, if you see what's going on there, is they wanted to bring and connect the traditional fiat assets with the blockchain asset. And it worked because it actually solved a very key problem that traders at least were facing, where they were very stuck between the volatility of Bitcoin and Ether when they wanted to trade. And that definitely has solved their problems. If you try to see it, the whole thing from a traditional space, for example, you used to have banks like, you still have banks like HSBC and DBS and other traditional banks. And then you have new banks like Revolut coming up. And people are realizing, even in the traditional world, that banks are no longer a physical entity. Banks can actually become a software. And this is what Revolut has basically showed us, right? These challenger banks that are coming up, the digital banks. And so everything is very quickly becoming a software when you have a software, you cannot just stop a software from talking to other softwares. This is how this open finance and open APIs are coming into play. Where, for example, if you are logged into your HSBC account, you might be able to use your Revolut account, or you might be able to use your insurance company, like Halifax, for example. And all of them, these entities, which used to be physical entities, siloed entities sitting on their own, are not able to connect to each other. And that's kind of happening in DeFi space as well right now, where you have MakerDAO, which issues stable coins. With those stable coins, you can use it in part of like a Compound and be able to get a loan out of using your collateral. And then you can use all of that for, I don't know, projects where you could use insurance of your smart contracts. All of the things are being connected. In the same way, the traditional financial world is starting to get a little bit more connected and a little bit more open and composable.
Yeah.
However, as you mentioned, the challenge is very different in the Western world and in Southeast Asian region, for example. Because even now, some statistics say that around 60% of people who are in this region are unbanked or underbanked.
Right.
So people who are developing or even, for example, planning to use stablecoins as a medium for for remittance, for example, in this region, they will have to think about. So when I, for example, when you transfer money from US to the UK, you transfer from bank to bank. But in, for example, in places like in remote places in India or even in Indonesia, for example, when you would like to remit money, you would like to the recipient to receive cash directly. Because on the other side of the country, you don't have a person who's holding a bank account. So a lot of these things have to be rethought, I would say, to be able to adapt those blockchain-backed finance or DeFi in this region. It cannot just be, let's see what we're seeing in the Western world and then bring it back to places in the remote corners of India or in Indonesia. That's not going to work out.
Yeah. So like basically from, you know, like when we traverse the whole journey from academia to the enterprise market, How do you think the future roadmap for Zilliqa looks going forward? Because, you know, you've talked about crypto as a force for good, you know, from spanning DeFi to offline as well. You know, like we were talking about how crypto can also make a financial case for a very huge unbanked population, which kind of sits
right
on 1.7 billion. And of course, you've also covered, DeFi has kind of given rise to smart contracts, EFs, and stable coins as well. So I guess I'm just looking for a bit of a holistic sort of perspective. If you could give us a bit of an overview on how academia element is also kind of fitting into the narrative.
So from my angle, obviously we launched our mainnet, Zilliqa mainnet, around mid last year with the smart contract features. And since then, a lot of things have been happening around and with a direction, because we are based in Singapore and we'd like to capture the market around that. And so we have, for example, been working with this entity called Xfix, which is a regulated entity in Singapore. And they have this license to offer what you may simply call the e-wallet. And so we have been working with them to be able to develop a Singapore dollar-backed stablecoin. And this is live right now on the Zilliqa chain, and now they are sort of extending it to be able to list on exchanges and make it available to normal people. They are also planning to extend that to Indonesian rupiah-backed stablecoin. Now, one vision there is to be able to build a remittance market between Singapore and Indonesia, for example. But in the end, we'd like to be able to handle cash in the end. So there has to be an easy, simple way to be able to convert whatever you transfer to Indonesia in cash. This is where, for example, Xverse works out very well, because they have the license to handle conversion of, let's say, your crypto asset, Singapore dollar-backed crypto asset into fiat directly.
Mm-hmm.
They are partnering with some local providers in Indonesia to be able to go to some of those small shops which provide services like where you could basically go and say, okay, here's my ID and give me the money that my friend or my brother has sent me from Singapore.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Please, go ahead.
No, so what I'm saying is that this is one line that we're looking at, but again, it also extends to lending borrowing. So for example, if you look at what we have seen, at least in the past, is people, especially you know, the workers who are working in Singapore and who have come from outside, they often transfer money back home, but sometimes they need to send more money than they actually, you know, would have in their balance sheet. So what they end up doing is they would like to take loans from the provider. I think there's a regulation right now that recently came up where MAS stopped allowing remittance providers to provide loans to those people in the, at the same time. But things are going to change. Where, for example, I think I heard in Philippines, for example, there's a company that got acquired by, I think, Grab or Gojek, one of those companies, working on remittance and lending. So that is also going to be a huge market there, but not lending as in large-scale lending. That could be even small lending, like lending of micro-lending, lending of, I don't know, $100, $200 of that amount,
right,
which may not be very exciting, for example, in the Western market. So things are going to be very different there. We're going to working with some of these companies to be able to change that.
Okay. Yeah. So my, these few questions are quite general. So, you know, like 2020 has of course been quite a challenging
right.
year for everyone. Are there any lessons that you've, learned so far? Perhaps you could share some insights and key learnings with our listeners.
Yeah. I would say that in most scenarios, it's all about people who you work with. And I have certainly transformed myself from a, let's say, CEO-like role to a chief psychological sort of person. You have to understand what people think. You have to understand and encourage what people are doing and empower people in some sense. And that definitely has sort of pronounced in some sense in this COVID situation. If you look at even huge companies, I think it was probably Twitter, announced that people from now on can just work remotely. They don't even have to come home and come to office.
Yep.
Things are changing. People are realizing that. And big companies like Twitter announcing this is a huge move.
Yep.
But then in that setting, some of the way you work, the way you talk to people will have to change. Because at the ground level, when you are, let's say, a manager talking to people around, it's when you talk face-to-face, things work very differently than when you are typing on emails or through Slack or other mediums. So that's something is going to change. And people who are managers or even at the C level executives have to understand the dynamics that have changed in this last 4 months or so. In terms of external communication as well, for example, as we discussed earlier, investments, the way people raise funds have changed as well. Road shows are now becoming very on Zooms and the likes of Zooms. And this is again where people, I still remember when we were talking to investors, back in 2017, people wanted to meet us physically. They were basically saying that I will not commit any single penny unless I meet you. I want to see you. I want to talk to you. I want to make sure that I can trust you, my money with you.
Right.
And that is not happening anymore. So people judge things differently. You need to be slightly more aggressive with the way you present your work to people. And people, we are learning from the way people behave is that you need a lot of more convincing power when you talk to people right now. Because face-to-face has a very different feel to it. It just by sitting in front of someone, you can change the way he thinks. And that unfortunately cannot happen right now.
Yeah. So, So leading on to that, we're living in a time where it's really in a state of flux with with the pandemic and of course market forces as well. And of course, things are just a bit uncertain now, right? We've got geopolitical tensions, we have trade wars, we have supply chain disruptions and all that. So how does a company like Zilliqa cope with these dynamics? Do you guys see this as opportunities that need to be exploited?
We definitely see everything that's going on right now, both in the crypto world and outside of the crypto world, the regular financial world that you see, or even beyond that, as an opportunity. Because when you have situations like this, this is when you actually understand, try to see the problems. For example, if you look at just Zoom as an application, right? People, yes, they were using it prior to COVID. But during this period, Zoom became, one of the biggest used apps around the world, and they had to cope up with the sheer volume of people wanted to use Zoom. The other sectors, for example, is advertising. The way right now, in the last 6 months or so, people have been spending more time in their homes watching Netflix, for example. So the entertainment and the advertising business has definitely changed and will have an impact because of what COVID has brought us. One of our sister companies called Achilles, which is spelled the reverse of Zilliqa, they have been working on advertising for quite a while now. And so that's again a market that people are trying to change and hit, because right now, when you even producers, people who are producing films, most of those films cannot go to theaters, and things are changing now. But until recently, most of them had to go to these platforms like Netflix, where they had to release on Netflix or Amazon or other places. So even the way, for example, these industries are reacting to COVID is very different. Gaming, for example, is another very critical area where a lot of people are now spending a lot more time on games. And that market, again, has seen huge bump. So I would say that COVID definitely has had its downsides. But in terms of market opportunity, we had several sectors which you could target because those problems that we were not able to see, let's say, 6 months ago, are now much more prominent and apparent right now. So we are obviously trying to target some of those opportunities where people, especially, for example, in the advertising sector, together with our sister company called Achilles, to try to capture that market in any meaningful form.
Yeah, so, Amrit, in your experience, you're the president, you're the chief scientific officer, and, I was just kind of wondering, would you be able to maybe just, list, not really list, but I guess just maybe put one or two key factors that you think, that are really important for businesses to kind of keep in mind, to navigate through these kind of trying times?
Yeah, so I would say that I'm not saying this from a scientific hat on, but more from a business hat on. I would say that this is a time when people have to be very careful, and probably this is not the most creative suggestion or idea there, but people at this time must be very careful with their finances, for sure. You need to make sure that you have, if you're planning to do a fundraise, that might become challenging and difficult. So make sure that your finances are in tight order. Make sure that you're keeping things in check. But also, at the same time, don't forget the point that this is also a time when you'll see opportunities. So if, for example, if you're an investor or a business investing in projects, this is the time where you can actually get good deals if you're interested in going and shopping around. I've still, despite all of this, I've seen some good projects, like some good companies, VCs, for example, like Electric Capital. They recently raised a huge a fund for crypto investments. And they are funds very active in investment in the crypto world. So if you are also looking for investments, go and reach out to the right people. They are still investing. It's just about finding the right people, because not everyone is investing in this model. And the other point beyond investments is fundraise is around market opportunities. There are clear market opportunities, especially given the way people are behaving right now. And you have to capture that human behavior and be able to provide them a solution that could change the way things are working for them. Uber, for example, if you look at Uber's example, it was for the very first time, Uber Ride, the one that delivers food around. Uber Eats has been more profitable as a business compared to Uber Ride. And this has been for the very first time, and for obvious reasons, because people are now staying at home, and this is where they would like to bring food from outside. They cannot go and eat at the restaurants outside. So there are market opportunities, and you have to capture those market opportunities by understanding what people are doing and how they're behaving these days.
Yeah. Just final question. Actually, it was just more about, blockchain as a technology and cryptocurrency as well as an offshoot of this whole paradigm, your opinion on the state of the ecosystem. But there was one thing that I kind of forgot to actually get into. There was a recent story about a business intelligence firm that spent almost $250 million USD on buying 21,000 bitcoins. I was just kind of wondering, you know, like right now, we've got, I mean, there are a few articles out there, you know, where you know, they're talking about gold and silver having a bit of a resurgence, and how fiat currencies all could be kind of, you know, on a decline, with, you know, hyperinflation, et cetera, and all that. So there seems to be this move where, you know, they're trying to get people to kind of diversify their portfolio and get into crypto, and they think crypto is too risky, they, you know, just like stick to gold and silver and kind of think this, try to get away from all the fiat currency. I just wondered, do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, crypto has been in a long winter for a long time. There has been a huge, very long bear market. Very few assets have been able to shine in that bear market. But things have changed in the last month or so. We have seen Ethereum, which had been, I would say, very stagnant for a long time, at around $150, $200 mark, has very recently gone and reached $400 value. Bitcoin has gone up as well. So obviously, when the market is favorable and you see volatility in the market, people start to trade around. This is where activity comes in as well. So I am not very surprised that you know, the company that you mentioned you know, bought a substantial number of bitcoins as a part of the treasury, and I think that's going to change as well. That's going to happen for other companies as well. People are looking at crypto assets as not just for retailers anymore, but a lot of institutions are very aggressive on getting involved in this space. So, you know, we have seen JP Morgan getting involved with Consensus recently. Yeah. And so I would say that this, and I won't purely say this all because of the activity that's happening in the DeFi space, but it's pure the ecosystem in general, not just the Ethereum, but the entire ecosystem is getting a little bit of more of support from the outside world. By outside, I mean the world that's sitting outside of the blockchain world.
Yeah. Just finally, before I let you go, just another thing, just on central bank digital currency. All these CBDCs now that I've kind of coming up. What do you think about these CBDCs? Do you think they really offer anything new, or they just, you know, like at least China, for example, the digital yuan is like maybe identical to the yuan anyway. It's just contactless, and you know, it's easier so that it can be transferred online. But where do you see this whole CBDC thing going?
Yeah, so there, you know, Facebook made an attempt to go towards a global currency. Again, I don't work at Facebook, but the move clearly felt like it was a little bit premature. You know, regulators and compliance people were not quite on board with the idea.
Yeah.
And so there was a clear indication from the government that they would like to have a check on this. They would like to make sure that if something is being used as a global currency, as a medium exchange all around the world, not just like Bitcoin, but a proper currency that people could have a support from the government in some sense, as a legal tender all over the world, it has to have support from the government. And this is what they were trying to sort of nail down in the discussions in the Congress around that time. And I think that was sort of the trigger. I'm sure that, you know, China was working on this probably much, much earlier than that. But that was also a trigger for many other countries to understand that if they don't do anything else around this, or this idea, then you can't stop private players coming into play.
Yeah.
And that, I think, has certainly changed the way the governments have been seeing this CBDC as a major play right now. China, for many obvious reasons, especially if you look at the payment space in China, it's very different from the way it works, you know, in other countries. You go to the UK, you are still paying in by your card and so on. But in China, almost every single payment, retail payments, goes through one of the apps.
That's right. Yeah.
QR code was, and Alipay have been there for like, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
So in the payment angle, China is way ahead compared to other countries. And it also makes sense in some sense for them to be able to push that angle.
Right.
obviously, from a decentralized perspective, there are concerns over there, but it also helps the governments in solving some of the problems. For example, the minimum wage providing, for example, I think United Nations or one of their IMF or one of those entities were looking at how they would be able to help send payments to countries affected with COVID, but push that money directly into the hands of people and not just go through governments. Because some governments may be corrupt. If you send, $1 million, only $100,000 goes back to the people. So if you have these transparencies with CBDC, things could probably change. So some governments might actually benefit from CBDC if you think in that way.
Right. Okay, Amri, I think it's been a great chat. We definitely need to get you on for another time. There are a whole lot more topics.
We'd love to.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for inviting me over.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.